Okay, on the one side, we have human freedom and a knowing mind. But on the other side, we have a universal mechanism, or if you will, a material body. So up here on the board, I have, if you will, above this line, human freedom and a knowing mind. Below the line, a universal mechanism, material body. How does a knowing mind get in touch with a material body? How can human freedom exist in a universal mechanism? And this tension, this problem, is going to characterize subsequent, will dominate subsequent philosophy. Here we have bodily perception down below. Here we have rational truth up above. How do you get rationality and body together? Now, earlier, earlier I said that it was characteristic of the Renaissance way of looking at the world to draw a dichotomy between what? Fact and value. Remember, nature down here, which is the realm of facts, and then you have value up here. Okay, now let's back up. That's the Renaissance mentality. What is the late medieval dichotomy? Well, faith and reason, or if you will, you have theology up here, and then you have philosophy down here. And then philosophy, as you've indicated, is the realm of reason. Theology is the realm of faith. Okay, so I hope you're reproducing in your notes at least this grouping of attributes, because this is the characteristic problem in developing a unified worldview. You have theology separated from philosophy, faith separated from reason, human freedom, universal mechanism, knowing minds, material bodies, values or facts, and they get separated out this way. Now, once you see this development in philosophy, in the history of philosophy, once you see this evolution, can you appreciate, can you understand why in our day and age, when people think about using reason and knowing the facts, that they want to separate that, you see, from theology, faith, value? They want to talk about this world mechanistically. Material bodies and a universal mechanism can be known by reason. Nature can be known by reason, as long as the facts, you see, are separated from a realm of value, faith, theology, what have you. This is the mentality that you were born into, because you were born into a culture where this is the spirit of the age. And by God's grace, you don't have to be caught in this. But when you talk to people today, you have to understand, they were not, no one came and drew a diagram for them and said, think this way now. They just take this for granted. It's part of the intellectual atmosphere that they breathe in our culture. But it has a history. And what I hope that my students will appreciate is what that history is, in terms of going back in the evolution of philosophical debate and dialogue. And Descartes is very important then for setting up the problems of modern philosophy. Before we move from Descartes to the next continental rationalist, let me mention one way in which certain followers of Descartes tried to correct the problem that he had. Descartes had a lot of problems. We've critiqued step by step along the way, but in the end we said he can't tie it together. He can't explain interaction between minds and bodies. Well, certain followers of Descartes said, well, then the answer is to deny interaction. minds and bodies don't interact with each other. If we deny interaction, then mind and body remain distinct substances and all of our philosophical headaches can be avoided. Yeah, this sounds good. Just deny the problem. If there's a problem with interaction, what is get rid of interaction? I'm laughing at this because, you see, this is somewhat characteristic of a certain mindset and philosophy. A certain mindset that says, I begin with things which are clear and distinct. I can be absolutely sure of my philosophy. And then when I can't tie it all together, well, that also cut off the things that don't fit. And this is pretty much the rationalist mentality. I like to use an illustration. It's kind of like Dr. Bonson thinking, well, I've got all this stuff to get into my suitcase, you know, to go home. And I know in advance that my suitcase is adequate. Somebody says, Dr. Bonson, you're not going to get all that stuff in that suitcase. Oh, yeah, I will. You just watch. So I pile all the stuff in. I shut that lid down. I crank it up. And I find out that I have stuff hanging out. Right? So somebody says, Dr. Bonson, we warned you the suitcase wasn't going to be big enough to take all that stuff home. I say, oh, yeah, it's big enough. Where are the scissors? I take the scissors and I cut along the edges so that anything that didn't fit in my suitcase is now cut out. And I say, see, everything that I needed is in the suitcase. Now, when I give you an illustration like that, we can see the utter absurdity. My friends, philosophers make a habit. They make a living of doing that. First, they propose their suitcase, and then people bring up the problems, and they go, oh, hey, that's no problem. Which is, as it were, cut along the edges. Whatever doesn't fit in my suitcase ain't real. Whatever doesn't fit into my theory, I don't have to worry about. It's not true. Later on, we'll be looking at a philosopher by the name of Hegel, and I think this is apocryphal, but it's one of those apocryphal stories that gets at the heart of the character of his philosophy. Hegel has a grand rational scheme for the development of history. And the story goes that one day one of his students said, but Herr Professor, the facts of history don't fit this rational scheme. To which Hegel said, then the facts be hung. Basically, then cut around the suitcase and forget what you call facts. Whatever doesn't fit my system won't be facts. And so here you have in the parallelist, that's what these students of Descartes were called, parallelist. They said, well, if Descartes couldn't bring together mind and body, we'll just deny that there's a problem. We'll just say there is no interaction. Okay? But now, of course, once you do that, you've got to explain the appearance of interaction. It seems like the mind affects the body affects the mind. How do you account for that? And the parallelist said, the behavioral patterns of mind and body do not interact. They are precisely parallel to each other. That is, in the realm of mind, there's first of all the idea, I want to pick up the glass of water. And then there is a perception in my mind of my hand moving, then a perception of my tasting the water, and so forth. That is one system of mental events. Okay? And in the realm of body, there is, first of all, a body standing here, and then a hand moving, and then touching the glass, picking it up, moving it to the mouth, and so forth. And the parallelist held that that's that series of mental events and series of physical events really have nothing to do with each other. They just happen to be precisely parallel to each other. Well, how can we get all of those things parallel to each other? They said God has decreed or intervened in the physical world so that though it appears my will is affecting this body in the world, this glass of water, what's really happening is my mind is thinking certain things, and God then is intervening in the world to have the glass of water picked up and so forth. And so the answer here is to say, well, God makes it seem like that. I thought that I chose to pick up the glass of water, but in fact, God willed that the water be picked up, and I have at the very same time an idea of the water being picked up and so forth. And so the physical world, physical laws, are not autonomous. Everything that happens in the world is actually a divine miracle because God's intervening to make everything happen. There are no physical laws that can be independently discovered then by the mind. Well, is that satisfying? Is this a good way to solve the problems of Descartes? Hey, we got rid of the problem. Yeah, but we got rid of the problem. Notice, though, by first of all, with an ad hoc solution. You know what ad hoc means? What does ad hoc mean in Latin? Okay. At this point, right now. Ad hoc means it doesn't have any system behind it that leads you very naturally to draw this as an inference. It just says, well, here and now I'll fix it up this way. It's like taking out the scissors and cutting the sleeves of my shirts off that hang out of the suitcase. It's ad hoc. Secondly, it's far-fetched. And if you're going to allow far-fetched philosophies, then let's really get far-fetched. How about this? We don't have any philosophical problems at all because this world was created 5 minutes ago, and all of us were created in this world, and we were created with our memory banks intact, thinking that we had a previous life and thinking that we had these problems. But in fact, God's really controlling everything. He just made the world 5 minutes ago. He's making us think these thoughts and so forth. I mean, if you're going to get far-fetched, why not just say there isn't anything that's real except what God has just recently done? And then we say, well, but we think that we were in class last week. Yes, but God built that into our memories. Well, we think that there's bodies in their minds. Well, God makes us think that there are bodies and minds, but there aren't. You see what I mean? This is not doing philosophy. This is running away from philosophy. It's like saying, well, the answer is we don't need an answer. Moreover, the parallelists have now sealed off the mind from the physical world altogether. And once they have done that, then they face this real difficulty. The amazing thing about the clear and distinct ideas of math and geometry that I have is that those ideas work in the physical world. I want you to think about this. This is something which the atheist that I debated a few years ago at UCI, you see, came totally unprepared because I was going to challenge him. If logic, or if math, to take a parallel case, if math is arbitrary, then why does it work in the world? If we think that our principles of geometry are arbitrary, then that means we could change them and we should be able to get by in the world just as well with a new set of definitions. Hey, try building a bridge and not holding to these principles of Euclidean geometry. Try it. And you'll find out, interestingly enough, that what you consider, what some atheists will say, are just arbitrary definitions for math and geometry, you can't get by in this world without them. So what that tells you is that this world is not arbitrary. And the parallelists, you see, have the biggest problem of all. How can they explain the utility, the usefulness of math and geometry if it's really just one set of parallel thoughts that has nothing to do with what God is doing in the physical world? Okay. And so Descartes, the father of modern philosophy, is a rationalist, and to put it very simply, he is a dualist. He believes there's two types of substances, and Descartes can never adequately explain the interaction between those two types of substances. In Spinoza and Leibniz, we're going to find two different ways of dealing with that problem. They will resolve the problem by holding on to the rationalist approach to philosophy. Spinoza, who was a Dutch Jew, over against Descartes, who was a French Roman Catholic, Spinoza answers the problem of dualism by proposing a monistic philosophy. All is one. Leibniz will disagree with Spinoza. He will hold to certain basic premises along with Spinoza. The Leibniz will offer an atomistic philosophy, atomism. And it would help, again, if you had the ancient philosophy course. Atomism is one of the most important of the ancient schools of philosophy. The top reality breaks down into undividable atoms of some sort, and so there's a great infinite plurality of things, all these little atoms. Spinoza says there's only one thing. Spinoza says there's an infinite number of things. So one's a monist, another is an atomist, and these are different attempts to deal with Descartes' dualism and the problem that it brings about. Before we take a break and I talk to you about the specifics of Spinoza and Leibniz, let's draw a conclusion already. I'm going to jump ahead because I'm afraid you're getting tired. I want you to see where this is going. It's very important. The rationalists are seeking what? Certainty. Certainty along the lines of mathematical models or geometric models of reasoning. And they say that they gain their certainty by deducing conclusions from clear and distinct, or if you will, self-evident starting points. But after we've studied the three major rationalists, and I've already got it up on the board so you'll see the point, rationalism is going to come off appearing very arbitrary, and no one can be confident of its metaphysical inferences. Remember, we're starting with what is self-evident, deducing so that we gain certain conclusions, and lo and behold, the three major rationalists came up with completely different conclusions. Dualism with Descartes, monism with Spinoza, atomism with Leibniz. Does that give you a lot of confidence that the rationalists really did have self-evident ideas and they deduce them with certainty? Well, of course not. You can't be very confident of these conclusions. They appear to be arbitrary when all is said and done. And isn't that the most shameful and the most embarrassing critique of a rational system of thought, that it turns out to be arbitrary? And you can see how arbitrary it is, because using common premises and making common claims to self-evident beginning points, they came up with completely different worldviews. And so that's one of the major internal critiques you can make of any rationalist approach to philosophy, is that it doesn't turn out to be self-evident and certain at all. And yet that's what it's aiming for. Okay, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll look at the details of Spinoza and Leibniz. All right, as we continue, we look now to the second continental rationalist, Benedict Spinoza, whose dates are 1632 to 1677. Spinoza was a Dutch Jew, a lens polisher by trade. At the age of 24, he was expelled from the Jewish synagogue and banished from Amsterdam because of his pantheistic or atheistic conclusions. He went to The Hague to live, and he was hounded most of his life with opposition. He lived a rather meager life, was never really famous and popular or wealthy in a worldly sense. In 1670, he published his treatise on theology and politics. And this treatise was prohibited by both Roman Catholics and Protestants. And so Spinoza seems to have managed to offend everybody. The Jews banished him, the Roman Catholics condemned him, and the Protestants prohibited the reading of his material, or prohibited, anyway, the material that he wrote as being sound. W.T. Jones makes this interesting remark about him. He was a mystic who was also a rationalist. Earlier, I had commented that Descartes began his rational philosophy with a mystical experience, these dreams that he had. And so this irony continues, that we have these rationalists who nevertheless have a mystical side, an irrationalist side to their thinking. Spinoza was impressed with Galileo's application of math to the natural world. He too sought certainty, as Descartes had, following the ideal of geometric demonstration. When you read Spinoza, you will find that he sets out definitions, and then he offers axioms, and then he tries to prove propositions by his axioms. I mean, he was, of all the philosophers, the most artificial, wooden, and stilted in terms of his presentation. He was going to be thoroughly geometric in the way he worked out his philosophy. And like Descartes, he believed that his geometric demonstrations provided insight into objective reality. They were not arbitrary definitions. This wasn't just, you know, one way of doing it, but this is what reality is like. Also like Descartes, the notion of substance was the key metaphysical concept for Spinoza. We've already noted how Descartes says that everything is substance or an attribute of substance, and this is a common presupposition for the continental rationalist. Spinoza wanted to apply geometry to metaphysics. And in doing so, he came to the view that reality consists of entities that are connected by the relation of implication. Let me say that again. Reality consists of entities connected by the relation of implication. That is to say, those things out there in the world that you think are connected by mechanical causation are in fact connected by rational implication. Reality consists of entities implicatorily related, logically related to each other. Spinoza wanted to begin with self-evident metaphysical truths, and from them he would demonstrate theorems that were implied by those truths. By the way, he had some 250 theorems that he thought he could prove from his self-evident metaphysical truths. And this would develop an absolutely certain science of reality. What was his science of reality? According to Spinoza, reality is one. Reality is eternal. Reality is necessary. Using his geometric method, Spinoza believed that he had proven that reality is one, it is eternal, and it is necessary. Now, what would Hobbes say about Spinoza, just in general here? Hobbes would have said Spinoza is only laying out for us the implications of his arbitrarily chosen definitions. And Hobbes would say more. He'd say, and Spinoza's arbitrarily chosen definitions lead to conclusions that don't help us control anything at all. That is, there's no utility to what Spinoza is talking about whatsoever. Spinoza, on the other hand, didn't look upon his conclusions in that derogatory way. He was a realist. He believes the real is the rational, so that what the mind knows is objective reality. When the mind knows anything, it must be in touch with an absolutely real, objective reality. Put it very simply, the nature of knowledge, which is mathematical thinking for him, the nature of knowledge shows us the nature of reality. This is the underlying driving assumption of all these rationalists. The real is the rational. So whatever is deducible exists. If I can rationally prove something, then it must exist. And everything that is real must have a reason for its existence. So there's two sides to this. Make sure you get both of them in your notes. Whatever I can rationally deduce objectively exists. Moreover, whatever objectively exists, whatever is real, must have a reason for its existence. And so to put it very simply, Spinoza is a pantheist. He believes that there's one reality, that's God, and this one reality is eternal, and he also believes this one reality is necessary. Everything that happens within this one reality that is God must have a reason for happening, and therefore it is deterministic or necessary. What do we mean by substance? Here's how Spinoza gets going. Substance is that which does not depend on anything outside of it. Go back to our orange book. Orangeness depends upon what? That which is orange. Okay, so the book is orange, so orange is an attribute of the substance. But substance doesn't depend upon anything else, it stands alone. That's what the rationalist understood as the difference between substance and attribute. A substance doesn't depend upon anything outside of it, as an attribute does depend upon the substance of which it is the attribute. Well, Spinoza was pretty rigorous about this. He said, but you know what? The book doesn't exist independently. What is the one thing that exists independently of everything else? What is the one and only true substance? God. The only thing that doesn't depend upon something else is the everything of which all other things are parts. And so it's the whole of reality that is the substance. Only the whole of reality can be called substance. And everything necessarily is what it is. Everything is necessarily what it is. According to Spinoza, mere possibility is a contradiction. Mere possibility is a contradiction. Everything is what it everything is necessarily what it is. So there's only two modes, really, the necessary and the impossible. There's no possible, there's no realm of possibility between those two. Everything is what it is, necessarily, or it isn't at all because it's contradictory. And so let's see if we can prove the existence of this pantheistic God. This is Spinoza's version of the ontological argument. I gave you Descartes' version of it. Descartes gives a causal understanding of the ontological argument. Anselm had a more definitional or implicatory version. But listen to Spinoza's. Is there any reason that makes God impossible? Can you come up with any reason that shows that God is impossible? Well, if you did have a reason, it would either be outside of God, some reason outside of God, or some reason inside of God. Now, if it's outside of God, it would have nothing in common with God, and so could not contradict God. This because most people who study logic realize you can only have a contradiction when you're answering a common question. And therefore, every contradiction has something in the two sides of the contradiction have something in common. Okay? Or if you will, a contradiction takes place under a common rubric. Sometimes we think we're giving contradictory attributes and the things aren't contradictory at all. If I say, he's not 39 years old, he's third at bat. You'd say, well, that's not a contradiction, Dr. Bonson. He could be third, second, first at bat and 39. He could be third at bat and be 40 years old. There's no contradiction because you're not addressing a common issue. And so Spinoza says anything that stands, anything that would show that God is impossible, that's outside of God, could not really contradict God. Therefore, if there is any reason that makes God impossible, it must be inside of God. But if there was a reason inside of God that made God impossible, then God would contain a contradiction in its own existence, or what we would say, his own existence. But since God is a perfect being, there can be no contradiction within God. So there's nothing within God to make God impossible. I hope you're following this. It's rather clever. He's saying nothing outside of God can make, nothing outside of God can contradict God, because then there'd be nothing in common. Nothing inside of God could contradict God, because then God wouldn't be a perfect being. Therefore, there's no reason, inside or outside, for God's non-existence. And if there's no reason for God's non-existence, remember, there's no realm of possibility, then God necessarily exists. Because there's only two possibilities, the impossible and the necessary. If God is not impossible, then God necessarily exists. Now, is God an attribute? No, God is a substance. And there can only be one substance, as we said. But Spinoza says a finite substance would be a contradiction. So there are no finite substances. There's only one substance. Only one, the eternal totality of everything. Just so you, I want this reinforced. Stop and think about this. Somebody might say, well, but what if there's a plurality of independent substances? Spinoza, why not a plurality of substances? He says, since substance means totally independent, a plurality of them would mean you have several universes. But several universes is absurd, isn't it? Yes, it is. Think about it. A universe. If the diversity is unified, that's what we mean by a universe, there can only be one universal system. Because if you have more than one universal system, then it's not uni-diversity. Then you've got many diversities that are unified. And so from the very nature of a universal system, he shows there can only be one. Everything real must be rational. But if you had a second universe, that is, if it had nothing in common with your own universe, I mean, it was really separate, it would be incomprehensible, wouldn't it? Because it doesn't come under any common rubrics or principles of thinking. So if you had a separate universe, it would be incomprehensible, but reality must be rational, so there can be nothing incomprehensible. Therefore, there can only be one universe. Now, I'm not playing tricks on you. I mean, this is the way he reasoned it out. And there's a sense in which I think he's absolutely right. But you have to remember that I'm driving to the conclusion, finally, that when Spinoza gets done, what he's given us is nothing but a set of definitions. I mean, yeah, you can prove that everything's God because God is the substance, and of course substance means nothing outside of itself is totally independent. Only the totality is totally independent.
Okay.
And there can't be two totalities. I mean, it's like you can't have 200%, really. There can only be one totality. You say, well, but Dr. Bonson, we as Christians don't want to hold to that kind of philosophy. I say, yeah. Arbitrarily, he can define himself to these conclusions. But let me show you what he does when he's done so. By this approach, nothing that is part of the whole is wholly true. Nothing that is part of the whole, nothing finite, is wholly true. Remember, only the total system, only that is the substance, only that is totally true. And so anything that is part of the whole cannot be absolutely self-evident, cannot be absolutely true. Only the totality can be true. I hope you see how that follows from his approach to philosophy. But now what you're asking is, Dr. Munson, so what's the problem with that? Well, then Spinoza doesn't have self-evident starting points, does he? Whatever he started with, because it's not the whole of reality, not the whole truth about everything, cannot be considered self-evidently and totally true. I mean, yeah, he's got this real fanciful, neat philosophy where everything gets unified, but what he sacrifices is the possibility of atomistic truths. And if there are no atomistic truths, then he can't begin with true starting points and deduce his system. Let me put it to you another way. This is just another way of stating this. On Spinoza's approach, you'd have to know everything to know anything. You could never start at any one particular point because that being less than the whole system is not absolutely true. So you could never know any one point unless you knew every point simultaneously in the system. If all is one, then all finite truths and experiences necessarily become illusory. Spinoza is not all that important in terms of where we are in the Western world these days. Not many people are followers of Spinoza. But thousands, I dare say millions of people are followers of this general idea that all is one, and therefore to know reality, one must have an intuition of the wholeness of reality. That's basically what we call, Eastern thought, Eastern mystical thought. Is monistic, pantheistic, and intuitional. And so the critique I just gave of Spinoza is valuable to you when you're defending the faith, and it makes no difference what the denominational variety of monism is that you run into. Every Eastern philosophy that assumes that all is one makes it impossible for you to know anything, unless you know everything simultaneously. And that's why ultimately, Eastern philosophies have a theory of knowledge that says you must have an irrational leap of mystical intuition. Okay, let's go on with Spinoza. Since the substance is the eternal totality of everything, and there's only one substance, we need to go on and point out that this God substance is not personal. It's going to be very hard to talk about Spinoza because I'm going to call it God, and I'll say he, but God is not personal for Spinoza. What's characteristic of personality is will, acting for ends. I've got a will, so I act to pick up the glass and take a drink of water. That's what makes me personal. I'm not some kind of mechanical robot. But you see, the idea of acting for ends implies that there's some kind of limit, some kind of external environment in which and against which I'm working. Isn't that right? I can't choose this glass of water to pick up and drink. I can't act for an end unless there's an environment out there that stands over against my desire. Well, here's part of the environment. There happens to be a book sitting up here next to the glass of water. Right? And that means that when I wanted a drink of water, I couldn't go like this. Pick up the book. That won't work. See, the whole notion of making a choice assumes some kind of resistance, some kind of externalness to me. If everything was internal to me, I wouldn't have to make any choices, would I? Okay, I'm thirsty. Don't pick up the book, pick up the glass of water. That's a very simple illustration, but what Spinoza is pointing out is that acting for ends assumes an external environment. But God doesn't have an external environment, does it? The totality of reality has no external environment, so God doesn't act for ends. God doesn't make any choices. And that is to say, God is not a he, God is an it. It's an impersonal totality reality. And since God doesn't act, God is not the creator, God is not the providential governor of all things. God is not loving, doesn't act to do nice rather than mean things to us, and so forth. When people speak of God having the attributes of being creator, providential, or loving, Spinoza says they are projecting from their own ignorance and insecurity attributes on the whole of reality which are not true of it. Okay, so we've talked about God, the one substance, the eternal totality of everything. This one substance is necessary. It is the all. It is necessary. It is eternal. It's not personal. Well, where's the world fit in? According to Spinoza, the world is not different from God. The world is the same thing as God, but from a different point of view. So you can speak of God or nature, God or the world, and you're talking about the very same thing. Please don't confuse this with saying that nature is God. Okay? It's not as though Spinoza has some kind of theistic personality running through the natural world. He's not saying nature is God. He says you can call it nature, you can call it God. It's the same thing under different ways of speaking. The same thing under different ways of speaking. The same thing from a different point of view. Okay, let's go back to Descartes and his doctrine of substance. Everything is either a substance or an attribute of substance, right? Or a mode of that substance. So then, whatever is not God, because God is the one and only substance, whatever is not God must be an attribute or a mode of that substance. Can you all see how, in a sense, he's just following Descartes' premises out here? There's only one substance, totally independent. That's the totality. It's impersonal. You can call it world or you can call it God. But that one substance, anything that is not the totality is then an attribute or a mode of the totality. And so mind and body do not divide reality. They are different modes of reality. And I just, again, because you're new to this sort of thing, I want to make sure you're thinking clearly here and properly. When he says they are different modes, he doesn't mean there's the mind mode, that's part of reality, and there's the body mode, and that's part of reality. He says they are both the totality of reality, but just seen in a different way. Each is the whole of reality under an aspect or perspective, but there's no substantial difference between them. And again, I'm taking this from W.T. Jones, but I think the best analogy, the most helpful analogy I've ever seen to explain Spinoza is like two different dictionaries in different languages. Mind is like a dictionary in German. When we talk about body, we're talking about the very same thing, but now we're talking about it in English. Is English part of German? Is German part of English? Well, I mean, apart from cognate words, just follow the illustration. Those are separate dictionaries. You don't look up English words in a German dictionary, and you don't look up German words in an English dictionary. Those are separate languages. Is one more adequate than the other? No, they're both true. There's just different ways of saying things. And so, using this analogy, we would say that the world of ideas and the world of objects is really just two different ways of experiencing or two different ways of talking about the same thing. Mind is a mode of the one substance. Body is a mode, a different mode, but of the same substance. All ideas are about their objects then. all ideas are about their objects then. That is to say, all ideas are true. In our way of putting it, we'd say some ideas don't have objective reality. I'm now thinking of a giraffe that has fairy wings and is flying. That idea has no objective reality. But for Spinoza, all ideas have objects. All ideas are about their objects, and therefore all ideas are to some degree true. Of course, sometimes men suppose that the object that they're thinking about is different than it really is. A man who gets drunk sees a pink rat on the floor. Now, he has an idea, and Spinoza says, since he has an idea of the pink rat, there is an object that he's thinking about, but he's confused as to what that is. He thinks it's a pink rat out there. We know that the object that he's thinking about is the alcohol that's affecting his cortex and his perceptual ability. There is an object. It's just he's wrong about what it is. That's pretty clever, eh? And so perception is just a confused idea. Because I perceive that there's a body outside of me, this glass of water. Now, there is an object to my idea, but it's not what I think it is. I'm confused about what it really is. So error is just a confused idea. And perception is always somewhat erroneous and inadequate, because perception gives me the idea of an object outside my body instead of an idea of changes in my cortex. I don't perceive what's happening in my brainstem when I think there's a glass of water out here. Now, there's some truth to there being a glass of water out here, but it's not the full truth. I'm confused, because the real truth is that there's something going on inside my brainstem that gives me this idea. Now, since reality is one whole, there's only one wholly adequate idea. There's only one idea. Remember earlier I used this as a criticism. The only truth you can have must be the totality of everything, the one totally adequate universal idea. According to Spinoza, this one whole idea is a nexus of implicatorily related ideas that exactly reflects the nexus of implicatorily related objects. I know that's a big mouthful. It's really not a difficult thought, though. There's only one totally adequate idea. And that idea has all kinds of other ideas that are logically related to each other. Everything is in its place. And it turns out that set of ideas, that nexus of ideas, everything properly related, reflects another way of putting it. This is another language. Now, let me put this in German for you. That reflects all these objects that are logically related to each other. It's just two different ways of looking at it. But there's only one whole, and the whole is always logic, the pieces, if you will, the parts are logically related to each other. Well, on that view, then, the laws of physics are a set of implicatory relations under the attribute of extension. When we talk about physics, we're just talking about logical relations, and we're using the language of bodies. Let me say it again. The laws of physics are a set of implicatory relations under the attribute of extension. There's only one reality, the whole. But an attribute of that whole, one way of talking, is body talk. And physics is just body talk about all the implicatory relations between things. And physics necessarily reflects the properties of rational reality. The world, understood as body rather than as mind, the world is infinite and continuous. And now listen to this. All distinctions between parts are ultimately unreal then. The only reality is the whole. And all of the parts then, and all the distinctions between parts, must be ultimately unreal. The real properties of extended bodies are not the ones that we perceive, but only those properties that we rationally deduce it to have. Okay, I look at the world and I think that tree is different from that car outside the window. But of course, all distinctions are ultimately unreal if everything is one. The only thing that is real is what I can rationally deduce. And what I rationally deduce is that the car and the tree are one. Well, what about ourselves? Spinoza says when we think about ourselves, we gradually realize this is not where we begin our thinking at a confused level, uneducated level. But now that you've gotten to the college level and I'm teaching you how to really think properly, Spinoza says we come to realize that our bodies are not in the world at all. It's not as though you've got a body in the world and I've got a body in the world and they're distinct from each other. Rather, our bodies are interconnected by necessary relations. Your body must be an implication of my body and vice versa. Why? Because he's already shown everything that's body is logically connected with everything else, and there's only one reality. The distinctions are unreal. Now, since body is just a way of talking about the same thing when you talk about minds, that's just, if you will, a German way of putting it over against an English way of putting it, then it turns out that as I understand that all bodies are one, as I come to understand that mentally, all bodies really are one, because the real is the rational and the rational is the real. Not only are all bodies one, therefore, now get this, this is where the Twilight Zone music comes in the background. Da-da-da-da. On top of that, that means all minds are ultimately one. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Turns out that your body is my body and my mind is your mind. It's really all one. Sounds a little bit like that Beatles song, right? Right? We are one, right? I am you and you are me and we are all together. This is very Eastern. See? We are all one. So our minds lose their limitations, which made them uniquely our own. That's a confused idea that you are a unique, separate mind. Personal uniqueness is an illusion. So at the level of sense perception, we feel distinct from one another. But that's just confused thinking. At the level of thought, we know ourselves to be all the others. Well, you got to get that in your nose, because this is wild. Spinoza is saying there are no personal distinctions. I know sensation suggests that to you, but there can't be. We are all one. And yet, of course, this is the kicker. Here's the guy pulling out the scissors now. He's going to start clipping around the suitcase to try to deal with our common experience. He goes, yet every element of reality has as partial an inner nature that is real as far as it goes. Spinoza liked to use, I mean, you read this guy and it's very heavy vocabulary, it's abstract and so forth. It can sound very intellectual. But of course, I cut my teeth in philosophy with the linguistic analyst and so forth, and our tendency is to cut through all of that and say, what a pile of poop. Come on. You've just told us the only reality is the one whole totality, the whole enchilada, if you will. But now, and so all the distinct parts of the enchilada are unreal. But then you turn around and you say, but they are real as far as it goes. Okay. I'm going to go on to expound Spinoza because it's getting time for us to go eat enchiladas. It's time to go to lunch. But I just want you to see that Spinoza here is cheating. Okay? He says one thing, he gives it with one hand, and then he takes it away with the other. The only reality, the only truth, is the total. But there is some reality as far as it goes when you talk about these separate things. Every element of reality, even though it's partial, has an inner nature that's as real as far as it goes. And so, as far as it goes, the partial reality of body, he says, is inertia. Bodies are characterized as partial reality now. Bodies are characterized by inertia. So that states of motion for Spinoza follow each other with absolute necessity. He's a determinist when it comes to bodies. Ideas, on the other hand, as a partial reality, are characterized by a drive to preserve their own identity. Ideas try to be what they are, not the opposite of what they are. This is kind of like a dynamic view of the law of non-contradiction. An idea, in order to be an idea, must be distinct, and that means it must seek its own preservation. And so the partial reality of the totality of this world, which I call my idea, is characterized by a drive for self-preservation. And all states of desire follow each other with absolute necessity, just like all states of motion follow each other with absolute necessity. Remember, there's a parallel between body, that's the English way of talking, and German, the body way of talking. These two are just parallel ways of dealing with things. And therefore, both physics and psychology are deductive sciences. Get that in your notes. Both physics, motions and bodies, and psychology, wills and ideas, are deductive sciences. They are not empirical. You don't go out with your senses to learn what the world is about. You must draw logical conclusions. Well, then how can you have ethics? Well, according to Spinoza, you have ethics. In fact, ethics is the culmination of philosophy, because philosophy or science is to be a way of life. But here's what he... In other words, if you learn what the world is like, that's a way of life in itself. That's our ethical goal. Spinoza is a determinist. He believes that free choice is an illusion that stems from ignorance of our true nature. If you really knew your true nature, you'd know that you're part of a logical system, and that everything in your body and your mind follows by deduction from other things. So there is no free choice. Secondly, in ethics, he was a value relativist. A value relativist. In other words, every man's values reflect his own attitudes and drives. What's the highest value for you? Maybe a different highest value for somebody else. When men agree in their values, it's only because they have similar bodies in a similar environment. Well, though he's a rationalist, I hope you can see that Spinoza has just set the stage for cultural relativism then. If you have a different environment, you have a different set of values. He was a value relativist. Thirdly, his ethics says that happiness is self-affirmation. Happiness is self-affirmation. Do that which is in your best interest. But, and this is clever, self-affirmation cannot be self-sacrifice, because even though it's not self-sacrifice, let me get this right, although happiness is self-affirmation rather than self-sacrifice, nevertheless, your profit is part of a universal order, isn't it? Because you're not really distinct from everybody else. And so instead of living in a cutthroat way for your own good, self-affirmation means affirmation of the whole. And so he's taken one truth and turned it into its opposite because of his monism. And by the way, what is that absolute totality of things? It's the knowledge of God. So for Spinoza, happiness is pursuing the knowledge of God, which is pursuing the knowledge of the totality, which is losing yourself in the wholeness of everything. And you do that even though he's a value relativist. You have your values, I have my values. But if we pursue our own affirmation, what we are is what? Part of the totality, part of God. So we're pursuing our neighbor's good and God at the same time. The more we understand, the happier we will be. Because after all, the order of ideas is the order of the world as well. And so if we understand the whole, if we understand God, that will be our supreme happiness. Well, I've had enough of this. It's pretty wild. Does it seem pretty rational to you, though? Begin with self-evident truths, and it turns out, look at the amazing tensions. We have rationalism and mysticism. Naturalism, rationalism. Determinism, ethics. All of them rolled up into one. Now I'm going to suggest the reason he could roll all of them up into one is because none of it made any sense to begin with. It was all arbitrary, based on, as we might call, a dream philosophy, an artificial coherence and purely speculative notions. All right, so I'm saying that Spinoza's philosophy incorporated unrealistically these amazing tensions. He was a rationalist, and yet he was a naturalist, he was a mystic, he was a determinist, he had a view of ethical egoism. It just all comes together because he has an artificial coherence based on purely speculative notions. It turns out that the world of fact, which he identifies with the world of value, is not the world of fact that we're talking about in our ordinary language at all. Let me just make sure at the end of class today you haven't missed this. What I'm saying is Spinoza brings fact and value together. But as he's talking about it, he's not talking about fact as you understand fact, nor is he talking about value as you understand value. It's just an artificial coherence based on speculative, arbitrary definitions. The world of fact that he's speaking of is not the spatio-temporal world known by perception. It's rather a world of logically related abstract entities. Spinoza's not talking about a world that you go and perceive and you know it's having relationship between objects out there. It's all rational deduction about abstract entities, not concrete realities or experiences that we have. And on the other hand, the values that he's dealing with are not as they are ordinarily understood. In his preconceived redefinition of things for his system, we don't really have values. Remember, for him, the only value is recognizing that values are subjective. Well, that's not what we mean when we talk about value. He says that's the only thing valuable, is recognizing that all values are subjective. The only freedom that he's talking about is recognizing that our actions are really predetermined and we have no freedom. So your freedom is to recognize you have no freedom. And the individual self, who is supposed to freely follow values, turns out not to be a real entity at all. There is no individual self, there's just the whole of reality. And so I hope you get a sense of the criticism here. I'm saying this is a total waste of time philosophically. Because we're not talking about facts and values as we do in ordinary discourse. He's got artificial definitions that unite everything into a coherent whole, but there's no individual self. There's no value that's objective. There's no freedom to follow that objective value. And there's no realm of fact out there that has causal and mechanical relationships to each other, but only what is logically deduced by the system. And so it's a dream philosophy, totally unrelated to anything except his own definitions. Leibniz started where Spinoza did, with his view of substance and other sorts of things. Leibniz started with a mathematical view of knowledge and the idea of self-evident truths. Leibniz started where Spinoza did, and came up with a completely different dream philosophy, his being atomistic. Now, we'll talk about the details of Spinoza tomorrow, but let's just get this much down. Spinoza begins with a rational approach, and he says, all is one. Leibniz starts with the same basic starting points, and he says, reality is infinite many. The very fact that they came to radically different conclusions should tell you something about how unreliable rationalism is with its self-evident starting points and its logical deductions and its mathematical certainty. And you understand, I hope you can understand, the frustration and indeed the indignation of people who would finally look at rationalism and say, who cares? If you in your armchair speculations can come to such radically different conclusions, you don't know what you're talking about at all. And philosophy looks like pure arbitrary sophisms, not anything that deals with what's important or valuable. Descartes was so sure of himself, he was a dualist. Spinoza was even more sure of himself, but he was a monist. Leibniz corrected both of them, he was an atomist. Doesn't look very rational, universal, and absolutely certain to me. Not if you look at the history of philosophy. Tomorrow we'll talk a bit about Spinoza. I'll be honest with you, I'm mainly going to do Spinoza so you're familiar with it. It's such a funny philosophy, but it ironically has something in common with modern physics. Spinoza, without being empirical, wants to reduce all of reality to units of energy. And you'll find that the most sophisticated modern physics has proposed that similarly. And yet he did it totally by speculation. We'll talk about his monadology tomorrow, and then we've got to get into the British empiricist. And I'm sure you'll come to class with the British empirical sympathy. The empiricist said, who cares what those European philosophers are doing? What we know is based upon sensation. Let's get out to the world of facts. And after we look at them, you'll find that their approach leads to skepticism, where no one can know anything at all. Boy, what a frustrating world this is turning out to be if you approach it with the autonomous presuppositions of the Renaissance. I hope that you can go home. It may not have sounded very spiritual today, but I hope you'll go home with some sense already of what Paul can say when he says, where is the wise? Where's the scribe? Hasn't God made foolish the wisdom of this world?